Well, thank you so much for coming on such a beautiful evening, and an extra thank you to any of you who are Red Wings fans. But you will get out before the first period is even partway through, I can guarantee that. My name is Doreen Markle. I'm the Managing Director for the Michigan Institute for Clinical and Health Research at the University of Michigan. We're an institute that spans all of the schools and colleges of the university, trying to promote, enhance, and excel in clinical and translational research. This particular forum is actually a grant that is an NIH-sponsored Partners in Research grant, a joint opportunity between the University of Michigan and our community partner, the Ann Arbor District Libraries. This is a very new type of grant format from the NIH where principal investigators, there's two, one in the community, Celeste Schott, who's right back there, who is the PI from the Ann Arbor, raise your hand again, everybody turned around late, from the Ann Arbor District Library, and myself, the PI from the University of Michigan. So what we have, what we're doing with this particular grant is bringing clinical and translational research education to the community. And another piece of the grant, which you won't experience tonight, is we are running different focus groups and evaluation sessions to really try to enhance our knowledge of the type of information that the community would like to receive from us about clinical and translational research. The screen in front of you is one of the products of our trying to reach out to the community. The Engage website is a website that started out just as a bulletin board of clinical studies that were looking for volunteers from the community, was enhanced to also be a registry of people in the community who want to get more involved in clinical research, and we're enhancing that by adding all types of information pages. We're way behind in having as much information in there as we would like, but the Engage website is our pride and joy, and the reason why the NIH awarded us this particular grant opportunity to make this a better tool that the community feels is theirs and not just ours at the University of Michigan. So that's what this is all about. So there's a series of these symposia with the community. Yes? Oh, that's a good question. The question was, what do we mean by translational? Translational research is just exactly as the word is defined. It's trying to bridge research from one area of science to another. So if we're talking about basic laboratory research, the type of research that involves petri dishes and cells and animal models, we call that basic science research. When we try to move that from the basic science laboratory into human-based studies, that's the stage of translation. When we try to move clinical research from human studies into community-based studies where we're dealing with larger populations or studies that are taking place completely in the community, that's another step of the translational spectrum. And then the translational step of moving it from community-based studies into influencing policy and healthcare delivery systems. So all of that is considered translational research, and our institute is actually focused on all of the steps of that system. Well, that's a very good question. Thank you. So before I introduce our keynote speaker for this evening, and he's going to then talk more about the medical innovation topic and some of the activities, I want to just take care of a few housekeeping activities. On the chairs when you sat down, there is a form that has an evaluation. If we can all take a moment while I'm making some of the introductions to just quickly fill out the box that says before the forum. Part of this grant actually requires that we ask you a few questions before we provide the educational activity and then a few questions afterwards as well. So they're very short, and then the other questions you can fill out at your leisure through the rest of the evening. But the before the forum questions really need to be done before we start. And then the end of the forum questions, take a moment when we finish, and hopefully I'll remember to remind you to fill those out again before you leave. Separate from this questionnaire, on the table where Molly is, Molly, wave your hand over there, there's a whole bunch of these pink forms. The Ann Arbor Library has their own evaluation system, and if you would be gracious enough to grab one of these, there's pencils over there as well. If you need a pencil, to fill out the before questionnaire, raise your hand and someone will bring one to you. Molly, can you? No, but, are there? Okay, so we've incorporated them. Raise your hand again if you need pencils. All right, keep them up until Molly hands you a pencil. Okay, the other housekeeping information is that when Dr. Geiger is done speaking and takes questions, we ask that you raise your hand and wait for the wireless mic to be given to you, because this entire session is being recorded this evening, so we won't be able to get your question on the recording if you don't wait for the microphone. All right, has everybody had a moment to fill out the pre-questions? Okay, good. So it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Dr. James Geiger. Dr. Geiger is the director of the Medical Innovation Center at the University of Michigan. He's an associate professor of surgery, and he also serves as the director of Minimally Invasive Surgery Program and the surgical director of the Pediatric Comprehensive Weight Management Center. So Dr. Geiger, as you can see, wears many hats. And we're very happy that the Medical Innovation Center is now affiliated with my institute, the Michigan Institute for Clinical and Health Research. So we're really trying to connect different entities at the University of Michigan as much as we can, as well as connections with the community. Dr. Geiger is joined tonight by the University of Michigan Medical Innovation team of fellows. They're bringing their experience from many different disciplines, such as medicine, engineering, business, and neuroscience, and are a modern example of a team science. So I'd like to introduce each of those fellows. If you could stand when I say your name. Steve White is one of the MIC fellows, a PhD candidate in the mechanical engineering department, about to finish, I hear. Okay. Elise Kemmerer. Elise has her PhD in neuroscience from the University of Michigan and is a MIC fellow. Meryl Sammy. Meryl has her MD from George Washington University and is one of the MIC fellows. Adrian Harris. Adrian has her master's in engineering and biomedical engineering from the University of Michigan. And Alex Kim. Alex has his MBA from the University of Chicago. So these are the MIC fellows that you will be interacting with later in the evening. So at this time, I'd like to turn the microphone and the presentation over to Dr. Jim Geiger.
Very much. It's really great to be here, and I'm so thrilled so many of you came out on a beautiful night. It's really great, and hopefully we'll have some fun. That's one of our fundamental rules at the Innovation Center. If it's not fun, we try not to do it. So this really should be a fun process. And also, I want it to be interactive, so feel free to ask questions and interrupt me. I don't mind that. We'll also, what we're going to do is basically, I'm going to give you an overview of kind of what we're trying to do with the Innovation Center, and just talk a little bit about what we mean by innovation and some other information like that. And then the fellows are going to come up, and you guys will have a chance, and I may ask them a few questions too, but we'll try to find out. They're coming to the end of their year, so I'm going to tell you what we had hoped to accomplish with the fellowship, so you can ask some questions to see if how close we've gotten. And then we're going to finish with a kind of hands-on exercise. We'll see. We won't be able to probably involve everybody, but we'll try to involve maybe four or so groups of five to do an actual problem-solving, a real-life problem-solving, group problem-solving interaction, something that the fellows do relatively frequently, where a group of people you know, from different backgrounds have to solve a common problem. And we'll see how that goes. It'll at least be fun, and hopefully we won't have scrambled eggs, and you'll understand more about that later. Okay, so I'm just going to start out by telling you a story. I'm a pediatric surgeon by training, so I don't know how much anybody knows about pediatric surgery, but it's a field that you train in general surgery, four or five clinical years, and then you do 2 years of additional fellowship training in pediatric surgery. And as a pediatric surgeon, you take care of everything from, you know, 400 gram now premature babies up to 400 pound adolescents. So it makes it somewhat of a unique specialty. We also deal with the full range of diseases, so pretty much every disease that impacts a child's life, and also, difficult situations and, again, the size differences is a big deal. And in pediatrics in general, but definitely in pediatric surgical fields, what we have available to us in the operating room is not always constructed for children. It's made for adults because the markets are larger and companies in general don't focus on those niche markets. So often we have to reshape things or kind of make them as we go to really be able to optimize the operation. So because of that, a lot of pediatric surgeons kind of are problem solvers and are interested in kind of figuring out a different way to do something. And that kind of creative thought, led me to work on a number of devices that I started to take forward. I made some really, by chance, connections with some colleagues on the engineering campus, and really, literally by chance. But those turned out to be really fruitful. And one of the first interactions I had was Albert Shi, who's a mechanical engineer. And he, at the same time, he had a pretty good premonition. This is 7 years ago. He was doing primarily automotive and aerospace type research. And he said, that he thought he needed to get into health research because he didn't think this automobile thing was going to be going on for much longer. So Albert had a student at that time whose dad was a pathologist at Michigan. And he asked him, who should I talk to over at the medical center? His dad had heard me talk about some of my ideas, and he said, you should talk to Jim Geiger in ped surgery. So I got this call from Albert Shi one day. He says, I hear you're interested in doing these type of projects. Should we get together? So we got together. We hit it off right away, and we've been working together ever since. And so it really started to then open up a whole new arena for me is to how do you bring people across, these big silos we have. People call them silos at big universities or any big bureaucracy. And it's really a challenge sometimes because sometimes you don't even know who's 30 feet away from you, let alone who's a half mile across the campus. So we'll tell a little bit more about the story and how we do that, but that's how we got started. I did put here our website. If you have notes, you can take this. You can also Google us. If you just Google University of Michigan Innovation, you'll come to our website. One of the things is really important for us is we really do want to engage the community, and I'm going to tell you more what we mean by community, but you can all have an impact on what we're doing. So first of all, definition, innovation. So this is Webster's definition, so something newly introduced, a new method, a custom, a device, but fundamentally it's a change in the way we do things. Now, there are some more modern day definitions. So Jeffrey Nicholson from 3M, he's the inventor of the Post-it note. So most of you are familiar with the famous Post-it note. So he said, research is the transformation of money into knowledge, and innovation is the transformation of knowledge into money. Well, it doesn't all have to be money. So we change it a little bit, and we'll say that innovation is the transformation of knowledge into value. And so what do we mean by that? So what we mean is that it's great, as Doreen pointed out when the question was asked about translational research. So at big research institutions like University of Michigan, we had last year, don't hold me to the exact number, but $870-some million of research, extramurally funded research. That's a lot of discovery. That is a lot of exciting fundamental discoveries. But there's a big step between fundamental discovery and impacting people's lives. So what we really need to do, if we're really going to impact people's lives, like we can write papers, we can get more grants, we can do presentations, we can add to the common knowledge, and it's a very important function. But if we're ultimately going to impact lives, that thing has to be transferred, that knowledge has to be transferred into some form of value so that it can, usually that means it can be packaged or at least taught to others, some way that it can be transferred to others so that they can use it to improve, in our case, health or improve lives. So this is an important, innovation is a word that's thrown out around a lot and has lots of different meanings at different times, but this is really what we mean when we say innovation. So our mission is basically to foster this innovation around the campus, to help bridge across some of the silos, and I'll show you more of that, and integrate a diverse group of people through education and research to ultimately improve health. And when I was probably, I think, 10 years old, or I don't know, something like that. My dad gave me a book on Edison. My dad was huge on historical, you know, biographies. And so I read all the, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Franklin and Edison. But the one that really got me was Edison, the book that he gave me on Edison. And I've reread the same book a number of times because there's so much in there that, you know, I keep getting impacted by it. But one of the things that Edison recognized was that he was one of these people, he's like a, you know, was a multiply Steve Jobs by 10. I mean, he could look at a problem and he could sometimes just see the solution and understand the need fundamentally, but he also recognized that he couldn't do it all alone and that he needed people of different disciplines. So at Menlo, he brought in people from all different backgrounds, and that's where really a lot of the excitement occurred. So at our campus, as I mentioned, we have this health campus with the hospital, the Michigan, you know, hospitals and new buildings going up, amazing research labs, you know, a really amazing medical school, a lot of amazing resources. And then you have a great dental school, School of Public Health. Our engineering school, equally, I think, you know, engineering school had over $150 million of discovery or research each year going on there. And just amazing depth and resources. When we've been up and walked and not met a lot of the engineers now on North Campus, something that a lot of the doctors, believe it or not, haven't crossed that, crossed the barrier. And it's just really, every time I go up there, I meet somebody new who I just can't believe how bright they are and how exciting the work they're doing. And we have an amazing business school. So the business school has something called the Zell Laurie Institute in it for entrepreneurial studies. And a lot of people who are really interested in understanding how they can impact this equation. And then industry. So when you have a big research institution like ours, you can't just rely on your own discovery to move it off the campus. We need to engage industry to understand where do they think the world's headed. And also, sometimes they have assets that they can move something faster than we can. Or we can help them with a problem where maybe they don't have the expertise in-house and they can utilize some of our resources to help make a difference. And so I think that, you know, we really see that the Innovation Center is really kind of trying to work to bring this thing that comes and works across the silos. I think sometimes people say we need to destroy the silos. I don't really agree with that because you need to have that depth and breadth of discovery that goes on at these institutions. And you need to have people that are focused on that. Not everybody should be worried about translating their idea. You know, some of them should continue to make fundamental discoveries. So, but we do need to bridge the gap. And when we bridge it, and we do it more by just chance. So, you know, if you look at a lot of the major innovations that have come off of U of M's campus, most of them do involve people of different disciplines. But those interactions kind of occurred by chance, or people kind of found themselves. And that will still occur. We're just trying to help speed it up at times. So some of you may be familiar with this graphic, which is a type of called mind mapping type of software. There's lots of different ones out. It's just a different way to organize your thoughts than kind of traditional kind of linear way of looking at things. But this is taking our mission statement and kind of dividing it up into five major areas. First off, creative culture. So at a place like Michigan, we're not like the coast, and we're not like Stanford or some of these places where there's lots of risk takers. Albert Shi and I, when we were thinking about putting the Medical Innovation Center together, we visited Stanford, and I was telling them about a particular invention that I'm working on, and they asked me, I said, I just need about $50,000 to get this really nice prototype made to know if my idea is going to work. And I'm looking for the money, and the people I'm talking to, one of the guys says, don't you have a MasterCard? So, you know, it's just the difference in attitude. You know, it's just, you know, well, I'm in the Midwest, you know, geez, I'm going to put that on my credit card, you know. So I just said, you know, there's just a difference in culture of people coming forward and with ideas and then knowing that they can take the risk. And I hope you'll hear from the fellows kind of their where they are with this idea. And one of our fellows is a skydiver, but so she's used to risk, but We really, this is not jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. That's not the type of risk we're talking about. We're going to really think it out well. We might take a little bit of a risk, but we got a chute and a backup chute, and they'll all be okay. So, and then collaboration. So just like the overall philosophy, we can't do it alone. Again, there's great resources on our campus. We have a tech transfer office that is really, if you look at it, and I've recently been around to a number of other universities, it's very progressive compared to other tech transfer offices. They have a mentors in residence program, which brings in people from the outside world, which is really valuable, and a number of other programs and grant programs to try to help get ideas going. We've recently formed a business engagement center to help us reach to the outside industry in a more standardized and proper way. And then we have made some of our own relationships with a number of companies, even a furniture company like Steelcase. You wouldn't think they could help us, but they have a lot of interesting ideas about innovation, and they have a healthcare division. And then community resources like Ann Arbor Spark and MishBio and others, which are out there trying to help us transform this economy and make a difference. So it takes a lot of resources, and we want to engage as many of them as we can and share what we do to help them as well. And then the educational program, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. We obviously want to help innovation. We're mainly focused on what we call the fuzzy front end, early in ideas, and I'll spend a little bit more time on that. And of course, you can't do any of that without great people. And and this is our MIC team. So Dr. Shi, who's pictured there below me from mechanical engineering, Jeff Myers, who's from pathology and has brought us a lot of great energy. Brenda Jones is our managing director. Jennifer Stovall, who's with us here tonight, is our now heading up our educational program. And Toby's our design and prototype specialist. Toby can make anything pretty much out of almost nothing. So he's really a talented guy. And then Susan Kaiser is not pictured there, who's one of our new administrative people. So we're a small team, but there's lots of energy, and everybody's working really hard. So let me talk a little bit about the education program. First, we'll share a little quote from Henry Ford. So and we're going to talk more about this, about the need. But you can't just always put a group of people together in a focus group in a room and ask them what they want, because they'll give you an answer like this. So they just want a faster horse, and obviously you can't do much with that one. I learned the other day, someone may not know this, but the inventor of charcoal grills, is also Henry Ford. But anyway, that's why it's Kingsford, the company. Anyway, another story. So the MIC Fellowship, this is just a graphic to show kind of the framework of the fellowship. So we really have the fellowship is broken up into three main phases that overlap or are integrated. In the first phase, and I won't go into all the details, but we try to create, we're bringing in people with vastly different disciplines and backgrounds. So Alex, our MBA, was out in the workforce for 10 years, you know, working in the automobile industry and other related industries, working internationally. So totally different background than somebody who's just finished a PhD in mechanical engineering. They speak different languages. They have different understanding and all of that. But the beauty is that once you give them a common language to speak, then that's when the excitement can happen. So in this first phase, we give them, we have what we call core knowledge that we try to pass on to them. So we teach them about the intellectual property process. We teach them about venture financing, business creation. We do some basic fundamentals on medicine and engineering, so some basic design, materials, maybe basic anatomy, where's technology, where's the hottest basic science research. And then there's also a whole bunch of support modules. The support modules may vary depending on the year and depending on what the trends are. And then we have what's called domain specific. So the domain means each fellowship team is going to focus within a domain. How you define that domain, we don't necessarily have the right answer. The first group of fellows was surgery. That's pretty broad. We probably won't make it that broad next time. This coming year, it's likely going to be aortic diseases. So the aorta is the largest blood vessel in the body, and so all the diseases that affect the aorta. So by the end of this knowledge foundation, though, and definitely when you get to the six-month period, and even our fellows, despite that broad domain, it would be amazing to, well, it's amazing to me to watch, but to hear them understand a problem, a medical problem, in great depth, and also to be able to speak the language to the clinicians. So it really can be done. We don't, obviously, we're not turning an MBA into a doctor, but it's just, again, that common language. In the second phase, we do what's called opportunity exploration. So you can't just, like I mentioned before, you can't just ask people, what do you think you need? You know, nobody would have invented many of the things that we hold or use in our daily lives now, because they were not needs that were expressed. They were needs that couldn't be articulated. So what you have to do is you have to go out and observe. You have to watch. We call it immersion, call it embedding them into the clinical environment. So we train them how to move in a clinical environment so they don't disrupt the clinical process, but yet they can be there and directly watch what's going on. So, you know, as a surgeon, it's very common, and they saw this, that we do a lot of things the same way every day. And we've done them that way for 10 years. And we just, somebody will ask you why, and you go, well, that's the way we've always done it, right? And it's in any industry. But that's where you start to say those why questions. Why do you do this, and why do you do that? And you start to understand that, geez, and you've seen that people are modifying something like I talked about earlier, or they're having to adapt something in a different way, what we call workarounds. So we teach them. When they go into those settings, though, we've already taught them what to look for and to some degree. And it's obviously an iterative process. They'll continue to learn. As they learn more, they'll know better what to look for. They go back and make further observations. They document those observations, and they turn those into opportunities. So in the Knowledge Foundation section, we teach them also about the art and science of innovation. What I mean by that is that any innovation process has to have a structure. It has to have a language, and it has to have a structure. So we worked with Larry Schmidt, who's here in Ann Arbor and owns a company called Inovo Consulting, and he also has an educational arm called Inovo Institute that works with us. And that structure allows the fellows to, when they identify an opportunity, they create something called an opportunity hypothesis, and then they develop these further and further, but they also, we whittle them down. So we use something called the wisdom of crowds to help whittle those down. We engage people in the community, and I hope we'll be able to engage some of you going forward to review those opportunities and tell them, do you think that's a real problem? Because if you identify a need, you can't just, one person's observation might be valuable, but you need to validate that need. Is it seen repeatedly? You know, do others agree that that's a problem? And so that's the type of process that goes on, and these opportunities are whittled down. And then the last phase is what we term creation, or we're going to solve the problem, and we're hopefully going to then translate that into a business so that it can impact lives. And in this phase, we try to leverage this vast discovery at Michigan's campus to be able to solve the problem. Now, in most cases, by the end of, you know, June, they're not going to, you know, be able to have the problem completely licked. So some of them in future years may end up joining with a research lab, or a research lab now with some engineers and some new collaborations that were helped created out of this to help move an idea forward. So maybe there's a research lab where there's exciting discovery going on, but now there's a new entity created that involves a couple of our engineers along with some engineering faculty to help translate that idea forward and make it a commercial reality. And so this is really kind of the process that we hope will happen. Now, when our fellows graduate, and their graduation is this Thursday night, you know, we hope that their lives have been transformed. And so later, like I said, you'll get a chance to ask them and see what you think and hear about their experiences firsthand. But I think that we have really seen a lot of that. And if from the time that they leave here, what we need to do is create what we term intellectual capital, or the people that can, in this economy, if you have a startup company out there, you would love to have one of our fellows now work for you if you have a medical startup, because they have so much knowledge and background that they would just be able to come into a position and help. And a lot of the companies that are forming out here, this type of talent is not here. So that's really what we hope to have happen. If they go on to join a bigger company and work in an innovative arm, that's still a success. Ultimately, as long as they do something after they leave here that impacts health, then we would consider it a success. And it's an exciting process. You know, any educational process, you learn. And the fellows have taught us as much as we've taught them, I'm sure. But it's been really a fun experience. Now, some of the other things that the Innovation Center does, as I mentioned, we tend to work on what I call the fuzzy front end. So one of the things is, first thing is just to get ideas going. So recently we just did a grant program that we partnered with MISHR to do, where we just encourage people to bring ideas forward. A lot of our inventors, especially the Medical Center campus, where we have our inventors are less knowledgeable than on the engineering campus, truthfully. They don't understand all of the issues, so they may even have some discovery, and they might go to a national meeting and start to talk about it when they shouldn't do that, because if that's the case, then we might hurt hurt the intellectual property. So there's a lot of voids in the knowledge. And also, just again, this idea of a culture of knowing that you can make a difference and bring ideas forward. So we help them. When somebody comes to us with an idea, sometimes the ideas are very raw. It's just an idea. There isn't actually a solution yet. So we help them to understand what's the need. And then we help them to identify resources, whether it's funding, refining their solution, prototype development. So we have, as I mentioned, the prototyping expertise. We now have some new rapid prototyping equipment, so we can really make anything and make it fast, which sometimes to just have a concept of know whether what it looks like to even know to take it forward is really important. We also are trying to provide active project management, and this is something that is not, for the most part, present on the campus. I think that a lot of the entities that are on campus around commercialization are evaluating this and how it's best to do it. But in general, invention on an academic campus, as I mentioned earlier, is that you have discovery, and then somebody who has that discovery says, geez, maybe somebody's interested in this. So then they fill out an invention disclosure, or they send it to the tech transfer office. And then the tech transfer office has to try to understand, okay, well, can we commercialize this? And that process works okay, and it's hit some home runs for Michigan. But it's not a perfect process, because one of the things is that those of us who are trying to do discovery, too, are busy, and we don't have all the knowledge bases I mentioned about the commercialization process. So tech transfer is spending a half of their time trying to educate the inventor. No, you can't do this. No, you got to do this. And then there's just barriers of time, and the projects tend to lag. And when the projects lag too long, then the potential opportunity is lost, because we're not the only ones in the world having discovery. So, and then a lot of times, the need may not really be understood. The inventor may have discovered something that is really cool, right? But when Alex could tell the story better than I can, but when they invented the laser on North Campus that, you know, became the technology used for LASIK, that wasn't what it was invented for originally, okay? It was an accident and serendipity that makes some of these things possible. So it really takes going back and understanding the need. Maybe this isn't the best thing to commercialize the technology for. And that's where this bringing multiple disciplines together to look at an idea is so important, because they'll say, oh, well, did you think about this? Or did you think about incorporating that? So that's the type of discussion we have. We call these cross-functional meetings. We bring together somebody with regulatory support, again, from the Michigan Institute for Clinical Health Research. We bring in engineers of different disciplines, sometimes clinicians of different disciplines, and really early on help to the idea to be refined and then move on to these next stages. Funding is still a big challenge. We really need what we term venture philanthropy. You know, for early stage in projects, there isn't funding available for. The traditional, you know, NIH mechanisms don't fund projects in these early stages, and there's not a lot of funding out there specifically for device-related projects. So this is still a challenge. We haven't whipped this one yet. There are some resources available for funding some device projects, but there's not enough. And one of our goals is to raise money to do something, like I said, what we call venture philanthropy. Maybe we'll even return some investment back into the fund. And maybe you could return some investment to the investors, but not to the same degree a typical venture fund would happen. But I think we can do this. We have tremendous resources at the university of money that could potentially be leveraged in this way. But it's going to take some doing and some people with a lot more power and vision than I do to make it happen. But we certainly see it as a major need. And regulatory planning, as I mentioned, is a big thing. And then the commercialization process, which is, it's variable depending on, you know, what's the right approach. And that's where we bring in a lot of the expertise of tech transfer, whether this should be something we should try to license. Is it something that we should try to create a business around? And again, we also have great resources at our business school to help with those ideas. So that kind of shows some of the groups that get involved in these things. And again, industry is also an important part of that equation. So getting back to Edison, so I never perfected an invention that I did not think about in terms of the service it might give to others. I find out what the world needs, and then I proceed to invent. And the other thing about Thomas Edison, so he was very focused on needs, still one of the most important things for inventors. But the other thing about him is he was never driven by monetary gain. A lot of people misunderstood that they thought Edison was somebody who really wanted to get rich. His biggest thing for him was if somebody was impacted by his idea that he considered a success. And he didn't care whether it was 20 people or a million people. Obviously, he liked big ideas, but that was really what drove him, not monetary gain. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the community, and this is a slide I borrowed from Larry Schmidt from iNovo that I talked about. And our fellows know what the community means, but we really think of the community as that's who we have to engage to understand these needs and desires. And so that means really getting out in the community and understanding, for instance, in health, the whole continuum of a disease, from the beginning of the disease forming to how it's diagnosed, to how it impacts lives, to what's the rehabilitation process, you know, every step along the way, what's that impact of disease, so we can really understand what are the needs, and again, the unspoken needs or unarticulated needs, which is the desires of that community, and then going through the process where we really understand these, and again, a structured process where these are written down and you know, quantified in a sense, so that they can be utilized to then drive looking for solutions. If we map on a campus like ours, if we map what the needs of our community, okay, whatever the University of Michigan community is, which is, you know, goes beyond Ann Arbor, but whatever that is, if we map what we're trying to translate off the campus to what the community needs, our success rate is going to be much higher than instead of forcing things off that maybe our community doesn't really need. And the other thing is that it's a two-way process. This slide shows it one way, but it's also a two-way process that the community can also help us solve problems. And I think this is something that we're really excited about and we want to start to do first on our campus and then with our alumni body and then hopefully more broadly with the community. But we have, at University of Michigan, we have over 300,000 alumni. So we came up, we have venture philanthropy, all these fancy buzzwords, but I came up with one the other day of intellectual philanthropy. But, you know, we ask our alumni for money all the time, but we never ask them to solve a problem for us. And it's really interesting. Procter & Gamble, which is a great model for innovation process, and the CEO of Procter & Gamble recently just published a book about their process, but they don't call their former employees, they call them alumni. How many companies do you know call their former employees alumni? And they engage their alumni. They have them organized in a network, 15,000 employees organized in a network. So 10 years ago, Procter & Gamble had developed 95% of its intellectual property in-house, meaning their own researchers came up with the ideas, they patented them, and all of that. Today, it's less than 50%. They now solve those problems with people from the outside. They work out the deals for the intellectual property so that it'll actually go forward, but they're speeding up their process of solving problems, and they're reducing their costs by engaging their community. So I thought this was great. You know, when Doreen asked us to do this, I know that it's a little bit different meaning of community, but for us to be successful, you know, we don't want to just be the, you know, the big, you know, white tower on the hill. And I think that, you know, that hopefully people will knock on our door. Our center right now is located out at Domino's Farms, and the door is always open. So we keep ours propped open. And, you know, we want people to come and engage us and, you know, share their ideas. And if they have things that they can do to help us in the process, even better. So anyway, that's a little bit about community. So we're going to skip this. We'll come back to the Egg Tower. Why don't we have, I'm going to try to answer any questions you have for me. And then while I'm answering some questions, why don't we have the fellows come up and we'll let you ask them some questions firsthand so you can get a little bit a better idea about the fellowship. But I'll go ahead and answer any questions if anybody has any right now.
If you have a question, raise your hand. Oh, here we go.
I'm just wondering, when you were talking about if somebody has an idea, bringing it to you, how do you balance that with the sort of classical intellectual community that crosses universities, so other pediatric surgeons and so forth, where historically you come together as a discipline and share your research and ideas and so forth. So how do you balance that research and those ideas and that whole germination?
Yeah, well, I think that it's a good question. We haven't solved all the problems. So we have inventors that have come to us from the community. And again, if there are always issues that come up, and a lot of those will revolve around intellectual property and how we spend the resources that we have to help someone, and how is that, you know, equation work. So we have to work through those things, but I think that we're really about not trying to draw what are sometimes artificial barriers, because when you start to draw barriers, for instance, let's say that Michigan has a technology that a company in Toledo should make. I mean, just because the company's in Toledo, I mean, they're in the same economic disaster we are. Yeah. Stanford or Harvard. Well, you can have multiple universities involved and solve a problem. I think, again, Wayne Harvey's here from our tech transfer office, so I'll give him heartburn over it, but that's for them to figure out, then the lawyers to figure out, you know, the intellectual property issues. You know, you're probably familiar, everybody's familiar with kind of open source type solutions and collaborative environments to solve some of the global health problems, the AIDS project and some of these things. And everybody said they can't be done, and I'm not going to minimize. They're more complicated for devices than they are for software, for instance. But we just have to redefine. You know, intellectual property law and rules will evolve to allow these types of ways to solve problems. I gave the story. These guys have heard me tell it too many times, so they've heard all my stories. But the iPhone. You know, when the iPhone first came out, four guys hacked the iPhone, and they were all in four different countries. They worked together and they hacked it and got into the iPhone. So it's not, we have to figure out if we can solve a problem to better the world, then we better work through those issues so that the people can come from Stanford and Michigan and Harvard and wherever else and work together to solve the problem. Those type of barriers are artificial barriers, and we can all benefit in the end.
So there are other universities, and faculty members that come from Harvard or wherever to here. And so there's interinstitutional agreements are set up so that the universities work very well together. So that's typically not an issue.
Okay. Question up here, then I'll come back.
Okay. Doctor, you have a really good experience with pediatric surgery. So I was wondering, what is the status, if any, of transplanting a preborn baby into a more appropriate womb? For instance, you know, when you have a 13-year-old, I think everyone would realize that a 13-year-old is not emotionally or psychologically, certainly not financially prepared to have a baby, but there's a lot of us believe that abortion is not the only solution. So, I mean, where is this? What's the status of that?
So you're not asking to put the 13-year-old back in the womb. So actually it's a great question. I would say it's an unsolved need. Actually, one of my partners, George Mielischka, is our fetal surgeon at Michigan, and his research interest is in development of what's called the artificial placenta. So there's a lot of things to be worked out, but the idea is that you would take a premature baby, and instead of putting them into the stresses of this environment, which they're not ready for, their skin's not ready for, everything's not ready for, that you would put them on some sort of support system, you know, to provide the oxygenation and the blood flow, but then also put them into probably a liquid environment that would provide some of the other things that the womb provides. So definitely an unmet need, a long-term project. I would guess someday it's going to be possible. Yep.
In terms of a clinician wanting to get some advice on what to do with their idea, do we advise them to come to MIC? Is that the first step? Would you have other advice for a clinician who has ideas? Is there some kind of vetting process?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're not the clearinghouse for all ideas. but we will talk to anybody, and we'll try to help them. So sometimes that help might be pointing them in another direction. And so one of the things we're trying to do, and again, we've been fortunate to leverage some funds from Mishar, is that we're going to provide an educational package. So when an inventor first comes to us, we're going to have recorded modules that cover these same topics that the fellows learn. These will be recorded in web-based, or you know, download them onto your smartphone, and so that you can start to speak that language and understand where you are with your idea and what needs to be done. So that's an important role I think we can play. And then if it's just an idea, or even if it's a very crude start of a solution to the problem, we do feel that at that area we can have an impact. So we can help hopefully find funding, help find collaborators if they're needed. And then I hope by the time it rolls across Wayne's desk at Tech Transfer, the other people at Tech Transfer, this is now an idea that's been vetted a little bit more. So we also have, for instance, we have a technology advisory group that is mainly made up of people from the outside world that help look critically at ideas to give feedback on whether this is one we should be investing time and money into. Because all of us only have so much time and resources, and you have to try to make those decisions.
MIC seems like a great idea, and I'm just curious, how long has it been in existence? How many successes have you had? And what structurally would make it even more successful, other than money, of course?
Well, you want to leave that one out? Well, so let me tell this. I told a little bit the story, but this is not a top-down entity. This is a startup. The MIC is a startup within a bureaucracy, basically. So I raised about $2 million of money from seed funders on the campus, so campus entities. So Mishar is a funder, the Office of Vice President for Research, the College of Engineering, the Medical School, the Surgery Department. I don't know if I left anybody out. The Dental School. And actually, our first funder and one of our biggest supporters, so I shouldn't leave him out. That they were people that, just like, again, for a startup, I went into their office, I matured the idea over time, and they said, okay, we'll give it a try. But we are not a sustained entity. We hope that the end product, and this is the first end product, which is, our fellows, is one of the things that we'll see. We're also working currently right now on 30 different projects at different stages to help move them along. Obviously, in any sort of process like this, somewhere between, hopefully it's around 20%, but 10 and 20% of those will ultimately have any chance for, even some degree of success. So that's going to be a longer term process, but we're certainly hopeful that we will be able to show that we do bring value. One of the fun things is that even though we've only been in existence, so we officially opened our doors last April, so all this has happened in a year. Our second fellowship class will start this July. Our curriculum, we've been approached by two major universities, University of Toronto and University of Texas, to potentially license our curriculum. And that's even though we've only been around for 1 year. And we're certainly being recognized in the group of about five or six other institutions that have medical innovation programs. So, I'm not satisfied with any of our progress at this point, really. I mean, we really just want to make sure that we continue to stay in this game and ultimately have an impact on health, and that's going to be a longer-term process.
I'm a BME graduate from Michigan. I now work in the medical device industry, and I'm wondering, how have you engaged the industry so far, and what do you plan to do in the future?
Yeah, so we've taken a different approach than some of our other centers or peer institutions, where many of them have kind of a group of 10 or sometimes 20 industry partners, and they pay like a membership fee. They get like a newsletter. Maybe they come to some presentations. And those type arrangements are okay, but what we've tried to do is actually to develop relationships that are a little bit deeper within that. We haven't worried too much about an exchange of money, at least not up front. And we've tried to, our strategy is to understand the company as best we can, so as much as they were willing to share about their strategic plan and where they're headed. And then we try to have them learn as much about the University of Michigan, of what resources that could be that they could potentially leverage. And then the relationships build from there. And some of the relationships have been really positive, but it's, again, each of those takes time and to develop. We have a lot of relationships in the community here that have also been really positive. So feel free to ask our fellows.
This was for the panels. First question is, what needs did you try to address this year of your fellowship, and also where are you guys going after you graduate?
Well, we had 130 different needs that we came up with throughout the, and by need it was something we spent 2 hours researching outside of the initial observation we saw. So then we distributed it amongst ourselves and another group that was our technical advisory group to try and whittle that down. And we ended up having seven big needs that we found. And through the year we focused on one, which is IVs that people get in their arm during surgery or during hospital visits. And we focused on that. And for the end of the year, we started a company based on that. And there's another company Alex can speak to that's working on something different. And I'm going back to graduate school to try and finish.
So why don't you tell them a little bit about what was the need that you observed, and then at least what you kind of, how you plan to approach the solution.
Well, in our observations, we observed in the emergency department, on the floors, in the OR, and everywhere we looked, everybody had an IV. And multiple occasions when we followed the, so we wanted to learn more, because every patient essentially who comes into the hospital for more than a day ends up getting one. I'm sure many of you have had one or know somebody who's had one. And so we followed the people who are specialists to learn a little bit more about how, you know, what the process is for getting one in, and what do you do with the hard ones and stuff like that. And so we followed the vascular access team and here at University of Michigan, and we learned a lot about how they fall out, for example. You know, they get snagged, they get pulled. We learned that there's a lot of waste in terms of effort. You know, the nurses try, then when one nurse can't get it, another nurse tries, and then when that nurse doesn't get it, then maybe they call the vascular access team. And so there's a lot of wasted time and energy, and every single try also costs money in terms of supplies that get used for these trials. And so we decided to focus on a way to save people's time and energy, the nurse's time and energy, and the patients also, the pain with every single time that somebody tries. The patients undergo discomfort. And so we took a step back and we looked at the inherent problems with the IV system and went from there. And I'm going back to residency and also maintaining my connection with the company, of course.
It's called Tangent Medical Technologies. We just started a month ago, so we're in the process of starting the whole commercialization process. We have a website.
We're Googleable.
Tangentmedical.com.
So all of you sit in the company, right? Or each one has a different idea, each one has a future company.
Well, we all worked together to come up with the idea for the company, and then four of us decided to go forward with the company. And Alex is starting one or more companies also that he was already involved with by the time our company came about.
I have a question. The first question, what is the criteria to be a fellowship? And the second thing, I see all the names are PhD, masters, you know, and community people. And I've been a judge for elementary schools, and I've seen good ideas from elementary students.
Yeah.
How could you cultivate or incubate this kind of ideas, you know, to innovations?
Yeah, so we agree with you. First of all, it's what makes up a fellow. I don't know that we have the exact right sauce, or no, we know exactly what that right sauce is. Elise came to us and was a PhD in neuroscience. She wasn't on our initial thing, but we liked her, so we kept her, you know. So we don't really know exactly. We do know that you want to have ideal people that would be fellows would be people who are actually cross-trained. So, you know, an MD engineer an MBA MD or an MBA engineer, which Alex is actually. Those types of things are valuable for sure, but you want people that bring in that tremendous depth of knowledge within an area, but also can communicate, have a passion and energy to want to change the world. So those are some of the criteria we look for. As far as in having everybody from an elementary student on up, the fellows actually ran some ideation sessions around trying to find, you know, understand the needs better and then also around the solutions. And they had actually high school students, I think, at a couple of your ideation sessions who, you know, came up with some great ideas. So definitely, you know, it's something that we want to reach out and you know, engage people to help solve problems.
Alex's kids participated, too, with coming up with ideas and giving them to their dad.
It's 8 o'clock, so we have to be out of here by 8:30. The activity will take about 15 minutes, about, so we can take a few more questions and get started.
You said you started with 130 ideas. What methodology did you use to boil these down in a short period of time so that you could pick this one, which is, I'm very familiar with IV problems, but to make this one successful?
This is a question we get a lot, and to our answer, we give a lot, though it may still seem very ambiguous. There was no defined criteria. It's using this idea that everybody brings their own specialty to the table, so when we sent out the list of ideas every week, there was about 15, and we'd send them to us and a few other members of our community. We didn't give them a criteria on how to vote because we wanted it to be their own personal either interest or maybe they had some personal knowledge into a certain subject, and it was to be a feel, a gut thing, and then ideally that brings out the true needs from the community.
So did this team all agree that IV is the one that you should go after? Is that the way it was?
That's what trumped everything in the end, was the voting process kind of guided us, but we made the decision ourselves.
Yeah, that's one thing they struggled with a little bit in the process, was that they would get individually passionate about a certain need because they made the fundamental observation that there was a need there. And they were right. I mean, these were all needs. They were all real needs. But at some point, they have to pick which need they're going to work on. So we engaged the community to help vote on these and whittle them down. And they got a vote themselves, but they only got one vote. So there is a very structured, even though the community doesn't necessarily have a structure how they make the decision, the fellows have a structure to allow them to whittle them down, and they have to live with the results. Now, that doesn't mean that in that group of, say, 10 or even some of the needs that didn't get developed that far down, that they couldn't go back to them someday. And actually, Alex has worked with us to make sure we have those well quantified so that we can use those to feed into some of our other design courses, you know, medical design courses on the campus. And let others work on that need, because they're real needs, most of them. It's just a matter of priority and which one they ended up with.
I think it's the wisdom of crowd that Dr. Geiger mentioned before. You know, although it wasn't structured, it actually, the number of people that participated, they weren't just anybody, just, you know, people who knew what they were doing in their own rightful field. So that kind of whittled it down, kind of like American Idol style of voting.
Okay.
You didn't have funding, like, you know, this is how much money we got in the kettle, so this is the kind of project we could accomplish in some time period. Did that come into effect at all in making your decision?
Yeah, I think it did, because this is the first year of the fellowship, and that wasn't the only basis for our decision, but we knew we only had a year-long fellowship, and so we couldn't develop some kind of groundbreaking new technology that would take 10 years of research and development. And so we decided to be pragmatic in the first year and go with something that, not necessarily that's easy to develop, but, you know, that we wouldn't need years and years of basic research.
And also given the fact that each one of us has an area of expertise, we sat around and decided on what project best utilized the knowledge at the table, and that's what we came up with.
I'm interested in writing some apps for cell phones, and I'm wondering if any of you are working on that.
Software is the only thing that...
Pardon?
We haven't done anything with software, but at Ann Arbor Spark, which has helped us out a lot, we went to their entrepreneurs boot camp. And there was quite a few companies that were doing a lot of applications for smartphones and cell phones and things like that. So.
A lot of applications, but any in your and area?
Not anything. I don't think they were medically. Well, there was one that was a pager-based system, I think, for...
Sorry?
Like a pager system for within the hospital to replace pagers.
Oh, that. No, I'm talking about physiological measurements, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there is interest on our engineering campus. We have a center for, you know, miniaturized, you know, electronic devices, MEMS-type devices, and there are a number of investigators that are interested in those areas. There's also an investigator in mechanical engineering who's interested in kind of using some relatively simple apps within the iPhone, for instance, for rehabilitation and other things with the accelerometer that's in there. So
yes.
If you have some ideas, we could probably point you to some people.
As a matter of fact, one of the things that I'm working on is wireless sensing technology, working with the electrical engineering professor at U of M. And we are looking into this thing so miniaturized that we're trying to actually implant into inside the cranial, inside the body, wherever. So if you're interested, I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards. And I also worked overseas, some of the leading-edge markets on cellular phone technology. So, I mean, I could talk to you about that as
okay.
well.
Well, I'll see you at the University of Chicago meeting then.
Okay.
I'm interested in your project involving IVs, and what you produced after the year, was this a product, or did you also evaluate process? And if so, where did you publish that, or where do you intend to publish that, and where can we get access to this information?
We have a product that we are still in development, and we're going to continue development on. And currently, we are stabilizing the IP, so we don't have anything published yet. We cannot publish anything yet, but hopefully, in the coming near future, we'll be able to talk more about it. As far as the process of IV insertion goes, we actually tried very hard in the development of the product not to change the nurse and the nurse's behavior as far as inserting it goes. I don't know how many of you are nurses or no nurses. They were trained very specifically to do a job, and companies that have tried to bring a product in that makes them change everything that they learned don't get adopted. So it was very important in the development that you had to look at your user base, and you had to acknowledge what the user base knew how to do and what they were going to be willing to change and not willing to change. And the process of putting an IV in something that they do 30 times a day, every day for the last 10 years isn't something you're going to change. So it's very important in development to maintain that.
But it's a good question because understanding processes or making up new processes have value. So most times you're not going to be able to sell a process per se. So it's you can't make money off them, but you can transfer that to other places, and we would consider that a success. So we have some kind of peripheral projects that work on that, and our industrial operations and engineering group focuses on that a lot. The other thing we've learned from that is that if you analyze a process in detail, usually if you want to improve the process, it takes devices to improve it. So it creates opportunities for development devices to change the process.
One of the things we learned through this fellowship is, you know, within that innovation fellowship, is how important the adoption process is. And if, you know, end of the day, it could be the best thing since sliced bread, but if people do not embrace it and adopt, you have not really made an impact. So that was one of the really true insight, but at the same time, it was, for me at least, is a very valuable lesson that if people don't adopt, you got nothing.
I think we better take one more question and then move on to the exercise. And actually, while the exercise is going on, there'll probably be some opportunity for some more interaction or questions.
Oh, that's great. I'm kind of excited to have the last question. So as a medic in my middle 20s, I'm truly enthused and excited that you guys as a team accepted that as a challenge. I think that there's few things that are far that will touch every person, and so I know you guys already came to that conclusion. I just want to say on behalf of everyone who has to emergently establish IVs, I'm excited that you guys decided that was important. And it, apparently you guys, you teased us as a group here, telling us that you have a solution, but you won't tell us what it is. So when can, you said the near future, and so I just wanted to know what that near future is and what journal we should look for or where we should look for it.
Hopefully we'll be selling it by 2011 is our product development timeline, which would be FDA clearance by then. So look for it in your distributor's magazine then, or however.
I think it's once patented, I think it, you could, I mean, it's, yeah, it's out in the public, so I think that's probably earliest time maybe you could take a look at it.
In the next month or two, we should have at least a provisional patent filed, we hope. And so, yeah, everything we do is on the website. Each of our baby steps that we make is on there, and so it's a good way to follow, I think, what we're doing.
I haven't gotten that far yet on it. I'm the IT guy, too. I do. I wear many hats, recording videos and things like that. So eventually I'm learning how to make websites. So that's my next step, is to get all the information on there.
And it'll be on tangentmedical.com.